This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hacking to save the world. I'm Tanya Hall, and joining me is Joseph Menn, journalist, author, and investigative technology reporter at Reuters. Welcome, Joseph.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a quick summary of your professional background and what motivated you to get into tech journalism and specifically security.
Well, let's see. I guess you could say I'm a classically trained journalist. I started out covering the night police beat in a small town in North Carolina, and worked my way up. So I was at the Charlotte newspaper for 5 years, and then I wanted to do investigative stuff. That's the part I really enjoy, finding out stuff that's important that people don't know about and then tell them. But lots of people wanted to be investigative journalists, and it's super competitive. So I thought if I could specialize in something like business, where a lot of the coverage was not very deep, then it'd be easier for me to get a job investigating. So I started covering business news for the Charlotte paper, and then went to what at the time was a unknown startup called Bloomberg, way back in the day. I got to investigate businesses, and that was fun. I got a job with the Los Angeles Times. And so I started covering tech for them out in San Francisco in 1999. So I've been a tech journalist since then. So more than 20 years now. And I gravitated pretty quickly towards security, cybersecurity and hacking. Really from the beginning, as at least part of what I did. It's been all of what I do, really, for the last 10 years or more. But it was always at least part. And I found it super interesting because it sort of crossed lines. It was a business story and often a criminal justice story and a story about technology and technology not working the way it was designed to. You know, I saw it becoming more and more a geopolitical story. So it was interesting because it crossed all those lines and most people wouldn't tell you what was really going on. There was this real disconnect between hackers who really understood the way things were working and the big giant companies with the slick PR machines that didn't want you to worry about, you know, didn't want you to worry your pretty head about, you know, how vulnerable your stuff was on the internet. So it seemed to me there was kind of a public service role in explaining that to a lay audience and to investors too.
You've written extensively about cybersecurity. In fact, your latest book, Cult of the Dead Cow, is an extensive review of one of the oldest and most respected, in fact, I would say most famous American hacking groups. How and when did the cult get started?
So they go all the way back to the mid 80s. And at the time it was, you know, a bunch of teenagers, many of whom had seen the early sort of movie about hacking called War Games and said, well, there's cool things I can do with this thing called a modem. It was sort of self-selecting because it was a real pain to get online in those days. And your parents either had to be rich or you had so they could afford the multi-$100 phone bill or to connect to bulletin boards, or you had to have some sort of university access a parent who worked at a big tech company and you could go to his office or something or her office. But really what happened was they traded credit card numbers and calling card numbers. And so one of the interesting things about it is that basically everybody was a criminal in the early days. And so like now, if you see a CTO at a giant, Fortune 100 company who's, you know, in there is roughly 50 years old now. At one point, they were a criminal. And that's interesting. It means, among other things, that you're used to making your own sort of risk assessments and moral calls. And sometimes that comports with the law and sometimes it doesn't. And so you would have people who thought it was like more okay to steal from a big company like AT&T, like steal phone service from them, than to steal from a little old lady down the street. And you know, you had all these, everybody drew their own moral lines. And that became more important as the internet reached more people and, you know, security became something that everybody needed to care about as opposed to just the sort of elite crew of early hackers. So Cult of the Dead Cow morphed several times. It was initially kind of like the liberal arts wing of the hacker underground. And they wrote these funny text files that were hosted on bulletin boards. And they distributed them to anybody who might be think they were funny. But they were often, they were like hip. And so over time, they attracted people with actual technical minds, the people that they sort of had aspired to be in the beginning. And you wound up with people from groups like The Loft, who are super technically proficient. People like Mudge, Peter Zatko, who would go on to run cybersecurity grant making at DARPA, is now, as we speak, the head of security at Twitter. And, you know, also worked at Google and lots of other places. And people like Chris Rue, whose hacker handle was Dildog, who co-founded Veracode, an early code analysis firm, now worth $1 billion. These people were much more technically savvy, and they sort of combined with the sort of performance art hijinks part of the Cult of the Dead Cow to have the, just like this huge impact inside hacker culture and then in the outside world, which is what they're trying to do, just make the place safer.
You mentioned text files. What role did writing essays play in cult membership?
Well, so they would publish their own files that they wrote, but they would also publish outsiders who just sent something in over the transom. And you know, if you wanted to be in, it was like a necessary precursor to being invited to join the group. So you had to write some text files in order to get sort of drafted. And their rule was that they would not accept anybody who actually asked to join because they didn't want to be hounded. They got to be so popular that like basically all of their friends and strangers would bombard them with requests to join. So like the one rule is you could never ask to join the Cult of the Dead Cow. They could only ask you.
So, and back then, I mean, hacking was an all male endeavor. How did the cult break new ground in this area?
Well, that's an interesting question. So most of the hacking groups back then in the 80s and 90s were all guys. That's who they know. Those were most of the early adopters. And then there was, you know, there was some like, I don't know, girls are scary stuff. Because, you know, we're basically talking about teenagers here. There was a woman who was asked to join pretty early. And the person that brought her in, who used the handle Psychedelic Warlord, was later revealed by me to be Beto O'Rourke, who at that time was running for president. So Beto O'Rourke was not only an early and influential member of the most important hacking group in US history, he also was the one that gender integrated it, which is super interesting. We never even had a presidential candidate who was a hacker before, let alone a member of an elite group like this, let alone somebody who integrated it in terms of gender.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What is it about Microsoft Windows that that drew their attention. How did Microsoft even respond to that?
So this was another really big turning point in the internet as a whole and the cult of the dead cow. So in Windows 95, Microsoft bundled in TCP/IP so that suddenly anybody with the world's most popular operating system could get online pretty easily. But they did not include really any safety features. And there was like a mass marketing campaign with like Rolling Stones, you know, they licensed Start Me Up by the Rolling Stones. And it was like, it was huge. It was huge news when Windows 95 came out. And one of the aspects of it is that, hey, you could go get online and go do things. And suddenly what had been, you know, the cult of the dead cow people and their brethren in the loft had been issuing security advisors to general public and to software buyers saying, you know, hey, there's a flaw in this program. You should fix this. You should fix that. But it was, you know, at basically businesses that bought software. It wasn't something that consumers had to worry about. And suddenly, like, consumers needed to worry about this stuff. And the cult of the dead cow figured it had to sort of level up to get the word out to them because Microsoft wouldn't listen to them. So the way they did that was to get publicity, because the only thing that Microsoft at that time would take seriously was, you know, a reporter with a microphone and a camera, you know, working for a big network or maybe the New York Times, saying, you know, gosh, these guys say your stuff is totally riddled with holes and anyone can take it over. So the two big things that they did were that they released a program called Back Orifice, which was a foul play on Back Office, which was Microsoft Business software. And that was a Trojan that allowed anybody to take over a Windows box. And at DEF CON, the epicenter of hackerdom in 1998, they threw CDs into the crowd with copies of Back Orifice. And like, you know, anybody could go hack a box. And they knew that a lot of innocent people were going to get owned because now a script kiddie could do it as opposed to somebody who had some skill. But on the other hand, they knew that by making it a spectacle in Vegas with like major media coverage, they would force Microsoft to do something about it. Microsoft was a monopoly. So there was very little leverage that anybody had over the company except publicity. So they went kind of the circus route.
What did cult members accomplish in the 20th century, the echoes of which still reverberate through the 21st century internet and cybersecurity policy?
Well, they brought forward so many things. So in the beginning, you know, there's overlap with the Loft. There are four members of the Loft who are also in Cult of the Dead Cow. And the Loft guys created coordinated disclosure, which is still, you know, still how security flaws get disclosed today. You know, you coordinate with the vendor so you don't like just drop it on the world without giving the vendor a chance to fix it. But there's usually a deadline so that they can't just bury it. This is evolved in multiple ways with bug bounty programs and the like. But you know, they sort of drove that. They invented hacktivism, which they coined the phrase. I mean, there was politically aware hacking before that, but they coined the phrase hacktivism, which has had an enormous impact over the years. So in sort of in the nonprofit world, you have all these people that work on open source projects that are about human rights. And that's where the Cult of the Dead Cow got more political. They tied hacktivism, or they invented hacktivism and tied it to human rights. So that might mean breaking censorship software in China, or it might mean protecting the phones or other devices of activists, political dissidents, minorities in various places around the world. It can mean a lot of different things. And others have sort of taken that banner and run with it. Anonymous, famously, in the OOs, and after 2010 as well. And more recently, there have been these breaches of places like, well, this week there was some hackers broke into an Iranian prison and stole videos that showed brutality. and posted it online. There was waves against Gab, popular right-wing social network where they got people's private messages and gave them to some researchers and vetted journalists instead of just dumping them out. But all the hacktivism goes back to CDC. On sort of the government side, they sort of bridged the gap between hackers and the government. I mean, there are always some hackers who are working for NSA, for CIA, but they made it much easier. When Mudge was at DARPA, he started something called the Cyber Fast Track, so that instead of these grant proposals and IBM gets an extra $10 million to come up with some new cyber weapon, it was possible for an individual hacker to get $50,000 and work in a garage with a colleague, say, and come up with something really nifty and get that into the government service if they felt like doing that. And in the private sector, probably their biggest influence came from creating a company called AtStake, which was an early consultancy where hackers went into Microsoft or big banks and said, well, this is wrong. That you're not thinking about the problem the right way. This is super vulnerable. We can help you fix that. And AtStake went on for a number of years. And the diaspora from that included all these great minds, including folks who are in top security roles at Google and Apple. Another AtStake alum was Alex Stamos, who was chief security officer at Facebook and blew the whistle at Russian disinformation in 2016. Katie Masuris, who's the godmother of bug bounties everywhere, got Microsoft and the Pentagon to initiate their first bug bounty programs. And Window Snyder, who was also a leading security light at in-house at Microsoft and Apple. So AtStake created this, all these amazing people and sent them into a world where they've, sort of coached a new generation of people. So really the Cult of the Dead Cow, which is still around today, is still doing stuff, and now has more than one woman. The most profound influence has been in their sort of training of new generations, inspiration of new generations, either in private training or in sort of volunteer hacktivist circles.
We love Window. She's been on the show multiple times.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, love her. And it's a really interesting book. You've really done a great job of explaining the history of this organization. So, in fact, if somebody wants to get your book, Joseph, what's the best way they can do that?
Oh, yeah. It's on all the major platforms. People love the Audible version. The narrator's really good, if that's your thing. And I love local bookstores. It's also available in the obvious online platforms.
Of course, who doesn't love a local bookstore? And of course, I have it on Audible. Joseph Menn, journalist, investigative technology reporter for Reuters, and author of Cult of the Dead Cow, How the Original Hacking Group Might Just Save the World. Thanks for joining us, Joseph.
Thanks very much.
Of course.
And I should have added my Twitter handle. I forgot to do that.
What is your Twitter handle?
It's just at Joseph Menn.
All right.
Well, we'll creativity there.
Thanks again, Joseph.
Thank you.
And find and subscribe to more of my interviews right here on all the major podcast platforms under the Tanya Hall Innovation Show or at tanyahall.net. Thanks for watching.